I'm listening to the show every morning, and you can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though.
OTB's Mount Rushmore.
Some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GAA boys weren't happy, but it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
It's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the coach, because it's something, unfortunately, inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there.
Catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM on the OTB Podcast Network. The OTB Podcast Network.
You're very welcome along to a very special treat for Off The Ball fans, listeners, viewers. I've got a man with me now who is very special in the life of one of the world's greatest sporting icons of all time. It's the man over my shoulder here, Muhammad Ali, Gene Kilroy. Gene is an Irish-American, it's fair to say. He was a business manager, friend, confidant, and a close ally of Muhammad Ali for many years. He's had an interesting career of his own, an interesting life of his own, by all accounts. But Gene's joined us now on the line from Las Vegas, Nevada, for a chat about his own life and his times with Muhammad Ali. So, Gene, thanks a lot for taking the call, and how are you keeping these days?
Yeah, Sean, everything's going good, as you know, over here, the virus and everybody in Vegas, everything is on lockdown, so... We're gonna defeat this thing.
Absolutely, for sure. Most people in the press would have known you as Mr. Facilitator. So this was a nickname that came about in the press for the work that you did with Muhammad Ali over your life and times. A good friend of yours, of course. Where did that nickname come from? What does the nickname mean? What was your work with Muhammad, and what did you do for him?
Well, this gentleman wrote an article in Sports Illustrated, and he said the facilitator. I did everything for Ali, you know. My title was his businessman. I did all his tax shelters. I did his investments. I did all the arrangements for all his shows. You know, all the people close to Ali said Gene Kilroy did everything for Ali but get in the ring for him. So I was blessed to be around a great man like that. And I liked him not because of his Irish heritage, but because of my Irish heritage. His great-grandfather came from Ireland. His name was O'Grady. That was his mother's grandfather. So he always said we're related, and then I would laugh and we'd make a joke about it. But, you know, I was blessed to be around that guy. There was no man on planet Earth as close to Muhammad as I was. I was with him when he was fighting, when he was not fighting. And here in the later years, the only two people that are alive is myself and his brother, Rahman Ali, who I'm in touch with very frequently. He's a good guy. We talk all the time. And talk to me, Ali's children do.
Your own Irish heritage, then, Gene. I know your was it your great grandfather on your mother's side was Irish and emigrated from Dublin many, many years ago. So can you tell me a little bit about your own Irish heritage?
Inchicore.
Inchicore, lovely.
Yeah. So they came to the coal mines of Pennsylvania, and my family was very active with the, if you read about the coal mines of Pennsylvania. The Molly Maguires, who was the first to form like unions, you know, and both my grandfather on my dad's side was killed in the mines. He was 42. And my grandfather on my mom's side, he was killed in the mines at 39. So they were left with, you know, a bunch of children and all, but they survived because their religion and they had faith in God and they were good people and they believed never to take advantage of everybody, do what's right. And that came down to me, you know, that was my mother's preaching and my grandmother, you know. I remember when we were kids, if the priest came in the house, it was like God was coming in. So they were very religious and they're good people. And I'm sure they're at a place a lot better than planet Earth today.
I guess the first time that Muhammad came to be known globally was the Rome Olympics of 1960, when he won the gold medal for the United States. That, of course, in that tournament in Italy was when you first met Muhammad. So can you tell me a little bit about your first impressions of him and how you came to meet
him? Your research. Well, I was playing sports in Munich, Germany. I played three sports. I was the only officer on an athletic scholarship. They wrote that up. I was football, baseball, basketball. And they needed someone to sign pay vouchers for the 60 Olympics. So they asked me, so of course I appointed myself. And I went in at that time, it was Cassius Clay and there was McClure and Eddie Crooks and Don Bragg. They were the Army personnel who were participating in the 60 Olympics. And we all became friends. And I remember walking down the street with Cassius Clay. And I had money because I was getting my government money. Those guys got nothing. And some guy came up begging and he said, I need some money. At that time, Cassius Clay, he had $8 in his pocket. So he gave the guy three. I said, why'd you give him three? That's all you have. You got another five there. He said, if he's lying to me, he's going to have to answer to God. He said, but I God may be testing me. So I realized this young guy, Cassius Clay, had a lot of depth to him. And then after he won the gold medal, he walked all over the village. He had his gold medal on. If they would have picked the mayor, it would have been him of Olympic Village. And I remember people from Russia telling him, you go back to Louisville now and you can't even eat in the restaurant. And he said, yeah, but we're going to change things. And his mother always instilled in him, make the world a better place than you found it, which he did. I mean, he's from a great home, a loving home, a caring home. And he always had time for the poor, the powerless, the oppressed, the deprived. We will never, on our time in planet Earth, to see a man who was as courageous. I used to tell him, if you weighed 220 pounds today, your heart would weigh 218. He had such a good heart, and he had forgiveness. He seen no wrong in anybody. I remember telling His Honorable Elijah Muhammad, his religious leader, I said he would walk in the bathroom and come out with two new friends, and then I would have to run them away.
Do you remember the first time that you realized that Muhammad had reached a level of fame that perhaps none of you had expected? Obviously, the Sonny Liston fight ultimately came around. But at what moment did you realize that Muhammad wasn't just famous, he was a world icon?
Well, he cared for people, which is the big thing. You know, he told me a story. He was in New York getting ready to go to the Olympics in Rome. He's staying at the Commander Hotel, the Commodore Hotel, and he found out where Sugar Ray Robinson's bar was. They told him go down Fifth Avenue, up 171st Street. He went up there. He's waiting for Sugar Ray. He's waiting there, waiting. Well, all of a sudden, Sugar Ray came out. He said, my name's Cassius Clay. I'm going to the Olympics, and I'm going to be the next. I'm going to be a champion. I want you to be my manager. Yeah, sure, kid, sure. He said, can I get an autograph? He said, I'll be right out. And he walked in. He sat down. He waited for 2 hours. Sugar Ray never came out. And then he said, I will never turn anyone down for an autograph because I know how that felt. But we used to remind Sugar Ray about that, but he didn't remember. It's like the bully. The bully never know who he offends, but everyone who he offends, they never forget. So everyone, the kindness of Ali. And he was just a good person.
A place that, from reading up on Muhammad's life, that was very important to him and important to his rise in boxing as well, was Deer Lake, Pennsylvania. So this was the 6 acre, I think it was, area of property in Pennsylvania. And I know you're a Pennsylvania boy yourself. What was, for people who don't know much about Muhammad's life, what was Deer Lake, well, and why was it so important?
I made a businessman out of him. See, here in America, the NFL teams, the NBA, the baseball, all that, they use their training camps as a write-off. He was staying down in Miami. Everybody else was writing it off. He wasn't getting anything. And I took him with a big accounting firm in New York. And then we met with the head of the IRS in Washington. And he showed them, you know, he couldn't believe this was possible. And then he realized it. So we bought 7 acres up there. And he wanted his own log cabins. It was his own creation. When he first came out of the Olympics, he went with Archie Moore. And that lasted a couple of days. Archie Moore had him cleaning the toilets in the gym. And Dick Sadler was there. And Dick told him, you're not here to learn to clean gyms and toilets. You learn to. So next day, Archie Moore walked in. He said, I'm not here to learn to clean toilets and gyms. And Archie said, well, rest up a day because we're going to spar tomorrow. I'm going to give you a lesson of humility. So that next day, Cassius Clay sparred with him, and he did a real good job. So then he left, and he went back to Louisville. And the only name he remembered was Cusimata. He was in New York, and Angelo Dundee, who was in Florida. He met Angelo Dundee when Willie Pastrano, Angelo was his trainer. He was fighting Alonzo Johnson in Louisville, and he went up, spent some time with him in the room. So that's how he got with Angelo. And then they moved him down to Florida. And at that time, I went with the Philadelphia Eagles. And after the Philadelphia Eagles, I became director of marketing with MGM in New York City. And he got in exile. So I helped him get a license back. We met different people. And eventually it took off in Atlanta and then into New York. So I told him about his own training camp. So when I came around him, he didn't even know about writing a check or anything. So he became a pretty good businessman because of my influence.
If you'll allow this comparison, I guess in some sports that have died off a little bit, they need a character, a certain character, to kind of bring it back up. Here in Ireland and the UK, the sport of snooker was quite big in the 80s, and you know, millions of people watched the sport of snooker on their TVs. And it kind of died a death, but there were certain characters like Ronnie O'Sullivan and Jimmy White and Alex Higgins who brought it back to life. Many people say that the world of boxing, since Rocky Marciano had retired, had lost a little bit of its, a bit of its drive and a bit of its appeal to a lot of the ordinary people. I read about Muhammad that, you know, he was a breath of fresh air in a dank, sweaty room. So what was it about Muhammad and the way he went about himself and the way he spoke and the way he, fight talk that made him so interesting?
In the old boxing days, the sports reporters would come in and they would say to the trainer or the manager, "Your kid looked good. Yeah, my kid looked good. When is he fighting again? He's going to fight in Cleveland on such and such a date. This is his opponent. We're going to get ready." Okay, good. They're right about it. So then all of a sudden, the Cassius Clay said, "I'm the fighter. You talk to me." Then they started talking to him, and he was always available. I remember 2 o'clock in the morning, a reporter would call from over in Japan and said, "Well, I'm working on a deadline." He'd get up and talk to him. But he always had time for the people. And he said, "You know, I never thought," he said, "when I was in Louisville, we had no celebrities come by there. We had a pole. And my dad took me by that pole." He said, "Joe Louis leaned against that pole." And he said, "Here am I now. All those guys know my name, Joe Louis, all the Kennedys. I put him in touch with the Kennedys," who was Irish. And, you know, the black people here in America, they didn't know when they were born, why they were born, where. They had no birth certificates. And his parents never went overseas. So I met with Teddy Kennedy, and he sent an embassy up to meet us in Deer Lake. And we filled out affidavits, and all of them got passports. And that's how they all start traveling overseas. But until then, they didn't. But I opened a lot of doors for him, and they was very appreciative. You know, I was the closest one to him. I was a pallbearer for his mom, his dad. I was in his wedding. You know, he trusted me, and he respected me. The big thing is, love. Children could love their parents, but they can foul up. But if they respect, they don't. Respect is a stronger word than love. And he respected me, and I respected him.
You mentioned there the example of Muhammad answering the phone at 2 a.m. And I guess, you know, you've written and said before that he was a yes man, and you know, he didn't want to say no to anybody, and he answered his own phone. Was that ever to his detriment? Did that ever hold him back? Was it a distraction to him? Was he easily distracted?
Well, you know, when we went to Zaire, Africa, he said, "Wow, this is, God sent me here to get this title back." He believed, his God was Allah. He believed in Allah. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad would call him before a fight. "You can't lose, Allah's on your side." So that was his booster rocket. Like in America here, you see guys crash the goal line. "Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus." Well, the other team, they must have Jesus. Jesus has too much to worry about. Plagues and viruses and wars and worrying about his sporting events. So he believed in that he has the law and that he couldn't lose. But that was his thing. And he was a very, very religious man, a very kind man.
You spoke about his parents there and acting as pallbearers for both his mother and his father. What impact did they have on his life, his mother Odessa and his father Cash? And also, I know you were with him and close to him, so you would have been there with him when they passed away. So what impact did that have on him?
I told you, I was a pallbearer when the parents passed away. You know, his mother was a homekeeper. She didn't work. The father was out painting signs, did all this, and he brought money home. And Cassius and Rudy at that time would bring people home to eat, and everybody would eat. And he would tell me a story. He said, "We'd all eat at my house." And I say to my mom, come on, Mom, eat. He said, I'm not hungry tonight. She wanted to make sure all his friends ate. But the father was a good provider, a good dad. And he told me one time he would go to the church, Southern Baptist, and he seen all the white people, the Last Supper. The father painted the Last Supper in the church. He said, you know, Cash, he said, Dad, where are the black people? They're in the kitchen cooking. And then he walked out one day, and he went down by a white church, and they were singing the same music that they sang in the black church. He said, and the minister came out and said, hey, boy, you got to leave here. You're not welcome here. He said, there's something wrong. Then when he heard the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, we don't have our own name. We don't have our own country. Angel food cake is black. The white devils, you know, the black car's in a race, the white car, the black car loses. The black guy wears the bad hat. The good guy wears the white hat. Everybody, you're in a fraternity, you're blackballed. Everything was black, black, black. So we knew something was wrong. And he did a lot to change it and create it and make everybody love each other, respect each other.
I mean, you've spoken as well about in the past his things that played in his mind. And one thing that would have played in his mind throughout the late 60s was Vietnam and the famous quotes from him as well. But deciding not to go to Vietnam and not having any quarrel with Viet Cong. But did that play in his mind? Was that something he spoke about a lot, or was it just a matter of it over with and done?
We discussed it many times. Now, if you realize it, in Vietnam, the rich people went there, who lived there. They went into London and Paris and lived. When the war was over, they came back and took over. Our young guys, if you were dumb, you couldn't, if you didn't have money or not too bright, you went into the service. All the bright guys went into college. And then they were alone. So now here it's come for the draft. They teach. They get a teaching degree, so they're not drafted. Other guys went up to Canada. But by him bucking the draft, you know, an unjust and unholy war, he was right on that. And later, McNamara, Secretary of State of the government, came back and said it was an unjust and unholy war. But here it is. Our guys were no got killed. The general, the top general in Vietnam, he has all the liquor stores in L.A. now. It wasn't fair. Our guys fighting the war, they had no business there. Couldn't win it. They didn't want to win it. They could have wiped them off the map if they wanted to. But he bucked the war. Now, because of that, then they changed the draft. No more draft. They're going to pick a pill. All of a sudden, here's Senator Gore, his son, gets called in. Another congressman said, they're going to abolish the draft. So he was one of the guys help abolish that. Now, let me tell you something else. We would go to hospitals. We'd visit the Shriners Hospital. It's a very charitable organization here in America, the Masons. They're all over the world. He would go in, no cameras. He went in to be with the kids, talk to the kids. And I watched him one time. There was a little boy, had no arms. And he didn't want to wear his braces, his artificial arms. He did everything with his feet. All he held him in his arms. You could do the shuffle, everything would be all right. I looked around, nurses and doctors were crying, you know. And then later, when he came before the Supreme Court, six of the Supreme Court judges were Masons. They said, how bad of a guy is this guy? He visits our hospital, no press, no nothing. So it opened up. When you're good, it comes back to you. When you do something good, nobody remembers you. Something bad, they never forget it. So with him, he did something good, people remembered it.
When you're speaking of the kind acts he did, I mean, I've read a couple of those. Jersey Joe Walcott that was beside him at a black tie dinner, and everyone was asking Muhammad for autographs and photos, and he told people down the line to whisper down the line to not ask him for an autograph if they didn't also ask Jersey Joe. Different times where a Philadelphia school teacher...
I'm going to tell you a story about Jersey Joe and I. We were sitting, Mike Tyson fought at the Hilton. He fought Trevor Burbick. And before the fight, we're having a breakfast with Jerry Eisenberg, the great sports writer, and Jersey Joe Walcott, myself, and Ali. And Jerry Eisenberg asked Ali, how would you fight Tyson? He said, I'd move on him, hit him, catch him, you know, boom, boom. You know, he said to Jersey Joe, how would you fight him? He said, we're not even going to talk about it. It's not going to happen. And I thought he made the best statement of all.
Well, wasn't there an occasion, correct me if I'm wrong here, but where Muhammad and yourself as well, in I think it was just prior to the Foreman fight in the Rumble in the Jungle, where you visited a terminally ill child in hospital, and it was quite an emotional moment.
The little boy came up to the training camp, and it was a hot summer day, June. He had a skull cap on, and Ali worked out and all, and the father came up to me. He said, "My son would like to meet Ali, and he got cancer. It's pretty bad." I said, "Okay." I brought him back to Ali, and Ali sat there with the little boy. Ali said, "Why do you have the hat on?" He said, I got cancer, and I got to wear this. I lost all my hair and all." So Ali hugged the boy, and I took a picture of them. And he told the boy, "Don't worry about it. You're going to beat cancer, and I'm going to beat George Foreman." Well, the little boy said, "I hope you're right, Ali. I hope you're right." So about 2 weeks later, I took the picture, and I sent it to the father, and the father called me back. And he said, "My boy's at the University of Pennsylvania. He's not going to make it, but I just want to thank you for everything." So all he did is road work. Him and we did the road. I was in the car. He ran. I would come back. So he said, "Let's go down to the hospital." So we drove down, from Deer Lake to University of Pennsylvania, like a 2-hour ride. And we're talking. He said, "You never know how lucky you are. Your kids are healthy. You thank God. Here's a little boy. He's trying to make it. I hope he makes it." Well, when we pull up to the hospital, when we get in, I had the room number marked down. Everybody mobbed us, so we head right to the elevator. We went up on the elevator to the little boy's room, and we walked there, and there was a little boy, Jimmy, his name was. He's white as a sheet. And he said, "Oh, I knew you'd come, Ali. I knew you'd come." And the little boy said, "Muhammad said, remember I told you you're going to beat cancer, and I'm going to beat George Foreman." He said, "No, champ, I'm going to meet God. I'm going to tell him you're my friend." And it was so touching. I got tears in my eyes. Ali got tears in his eyes. And on the way back, there wasn't much said in the car. But could you imagine? You go in a restaurant in Dublin, and you mention Red Hurley's name, you're going to get a good seat. "I'm a friend of Red Hurley. You're going to meet." You go to meet God. You say, "I'm a friend of Muhammad Ali." What a compliment that is. So about a week later, I got a call from the father. He said, "The little boy died." And I told Ali. Ali said, "I said, I'm going to go over. You want to go?" "No, I'll be too sad." So I went over, and in the casket, they had that picture. "You're going to beat cancer. I'm going to beat George Foreman." But that's the type of guy Ali was. We went to an old folks home one time around the camp. Old guy in there. We walked in there, and then the nurse said, "Mr. DeCasmero, you know this guy?" He said, "That's Joe Louis." We laughed. Ali looked at us, stared at us. "That's right, I'm Joe Louis." He hugged the guy. The guy said, "Thank you, Joe, for coming." So we leave. We're leaving. I said, "What was it?" He said, he didn't know Muhammad Ali. He knew Joe Louis. So let him realize he met Joe Louis. But this is the depth that this guy had. In New York, there was a Jewish home. They were putting them out. We watched it on the news, find out where it is. We went over. We go to the people. They couldn't collect Social Security, unemployment, nothing. They're going to close it down. "Who's in charge here?" The guy said, "I am." Ali said, "We're going to write you a check now for $300,000. You can cash it right now. And we're going to write another one for $200,000. Hold off a week." And he wrote it. I wrote it out. He signed it, gave it to him. They said, "Oh, thank you." So we get back in the car. He said, "I could have made that in an exhibition." He said, "Kindness to others is the only rent we pay for our room on earth." So we did something good to those people. I mean, he wasn't prejudiced. Jewish people, they hollered Muslim. He wasn't about that.
When you talk about money, was money something that Ali had a strange relationship with in terms of his knowledge of money? And I know you helped him out in his finances. And I'd read different anecdotes where sometimes he'd be passing by getting gas in his car, and he'd only top up by 50 cents because he'd think, "I'm saving money here," rather than...
No. He didn't care about money.
Didn't care.
He didn't care about money. I remember one time we left the training camp. We're going into New York. We used to stop in a gas station. He went in the gas station, put his coat up, went to the bathroom. We come out, we get to New York. He said, "I left my coat in that bathroom." I said, "Oh, shit. Was there any money?" "Yeah. There was $80,000. I said, "Wow, let me head back and get it." He said, "It's probably gone." I said, "No, I drove all the way back. that was closed. There was a sign on the door. I called the guy. The guy came up. He went in and gave me the coat. I give the guy $2,000 as a tip for coming in. I take him back to Ali. I said, well, I gave the guy $2,000. He said, you should have gave him $10. You know, that's the way he would think. But he didn't care about money.
If I get to some of his big fights, Joe Frazier is someone who he'll be inextricably linked with for the rest of eternity. Three massive fights, including the thriller in Manila, of course. But I'm reminded of a car journey that the two of them took together in 1970 before they ever even fought. I think it was from New York to Philadelphia.
Where Joe Frazier gave him money, that never happened.
Never happened?
No.
What was the relationship between Joe and Muhammad like? I know there was a lot of smack talk back and forth.
I was very close with Joe Frazier. I had a friend of mine was in the 64 Olympics. He won a flyweight. He won the bronze medal, Bobby Carmody. He introduced me to Joe. At that time, I was with the Philadelphia Eagles, and Joe was close to Carmody, and I got very close to Joe. Carmody was killed in the service. I went. He was the only Olympic guy ever killed in the service. And I called Joe. We went to the funeral, and I thought people would be mad at me because Ali went to draft. But everybody was glad to see me. They said, there should be more people like him. But I was very close with Joe. And Joe would say, I don't like him. You know, he said, how would you like your kids going to school? And they're called, your daddy's a gorilla. I said, Joe, he don't man. He said, I'm going to kick his ass. You know, So I said, someday we're all going to sit down in the park and have a good relation, a good talk. You know, he's just selling tickets. And then I took Ali to Joe's funeral, and it was sad. And the minister spoke there at it, and he talked about Howard Cosell. Down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier. He said, then came a man who's sitting here, Muhammad Ali. He gave Joe Frazier a new life. He beat Foreman, and Joe came right back. Thank you, Muhammad Ali. You know, and Ali truly loved Joe Frazier. He was sad about him. But Joe, in the end, he respected Ali. He used to call him my man, my man. I remember a story one time I told Joe, we're coming down the Pennsylvania Turnpike. We're going about 80 miles an hour. And Joe, Ali's driving. All of a sudden, the cops come up. Pull over. The loudspeaker's on. We pull over. Ali gets out of the car. The cop said, where do you think you're going? He said, I'm looking for Joe Frazier. Where's Joe Frazier? The cop looked. He said, you better get back in the car. Slow down. Now, if he would have got out of the car and said, I'm Muhammad Ali, I hope I don't get a ticket, the guy might have given him one. But with the wit that he had, I'm looking. And then I told Joe later, I said, you saved us a ticket. What are you talking? And I told him, he said, they should have put him in jail.
You mentioned the word wit there, and he, obviously Muhammad was well known for his wit and his one-liners and his poems and his fighting talk. I know a lot of boxers in that era certainly wouldn't have had a lot of education, or certainly wouldn't have gone past, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth, whatever grade it was, in terms of education. Where did Muhammad get his wit? How was he so quick-witted?
With his father and mom and all. Let me tell you something. Talking about fighters, 92% of the fighters don't even have an eighth grade education. 94% of them are all broke today.
Why?
And all the ones who have money, they made it after boxing. Ali, George Foreman, De La Hoya, all the rest. They don't have people looking out for them. I looked out for Ali. We never had a tax problem. We looked out, you know, a whole different avenue. But they didn't have that. They had people, they would keep the fighter fighting because they got the 30%, even though he was getting beat. I mean, it's unbelievable today.
Those lines, I mean, I'm reminded, I'm a bit of a space geek, and I've interviewed Buzz Aldrin, met him a couple of times. I know he's a good friend of yours as well. I know that's why I brought him up. But obviously Buzz walked on the moon with Neil Armstrong, and those famous words that Neil said, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. He claimed to his dying day that, you know, he didn't really plan those words in advance, that they kind of came to him in the moment. And one of the most quoted phrases of all time. Muhammad had some of the most quoted phrases of all time as well. Many of them, in fact. Were those phrases that he came up with on the spot, or were they preordained?
He would read books and study and hear different people speaking, and then he would change it his way. But he was like a sponge. He sucked up everything. You know, a very bright guy. When he graduated from high school, He was, I think there was 140 in the class. He was 138. He didn't know how to read. He went in. He had a girlfriend when he went into the Olympics. He never wrote her because he didn't know how to write. Louisville, all that. He was embarrassed to ask somebody. But he picked it up later, you know.
Another fighter you mentioned there is George Foreman. And I mean, I watched When We Were Kings last night. Many people will have seen it. The story of the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire and how that fight came about. Incredible fight. How did that fight come about? I know you were quite key in the build-up to that fight, and you were over in Zaire famously with him. So what do you remember of the build-up to that one?
The one that put that together was Hank Swartz, Video Hamdale. And then he got John Daly from London to put up the money. Now they needed to sign George Foreman. George wouldn't fight him. So they sent Don King out to talk to George. And he told George, $5 million, and this is an easy fight for you. The guy hasn't fought in 10 years. You beat him. Okay, he signed the contract. Well, Ali didn't have any fear. Ali had no fear of him. You know, Ali said to Cusumano, how do I fight this guy? He said, you must throw your punches with bad intentions. He said, your first punch, you must hit him so hard. And I said, well, look at Cus. Look what Foreman did to Norton. Look what he did to Frazier. That's not Ali. So Ali said, I know what I'm doing. And I went in the dressing room when they were taping Foreman's hands. Dick Sadler was there, Archie Moore. I felt death in the air. So I go back to Ali's dressing room. He said, what's he saying? I said, he's talking about putting your kids in an orphanage. Oh, I can't wait to get them. And if you watch the fight, you'll see George coming out like this. And Ali hits him, boom. And the lights went out. And then Ali abused him. George was knocked guys down, step on him to get to the neutral corner. He couldn't do that with Ali. Ali had no fear.
So you were in that dressing room with Foreman for his gloving process. So you would have been in the Ali's dressing room, of course. What was the difference for that Rumble in the Jungle? What was the difference in atmosphere in the two dressing rooms?
We were relaxed in our dressing room. I mean, in Foreman, they were pretty tense. Ali, you know, this is my fight tonight. I came back to Africa to get my crown. Ali was so popular in Africa. If he'd have told the people, we were there so long with the cut and all. If he'd have told the people, I want to be your king, they might have marched Mabuda out of there. But the people loved him. Everybody loved him over there.
Ali Bomaye, I think, was the phrase that
when we got off the airplane, Ali turned to me. He said, who don't they like here? I said, I guess white people. He said, well, I can't say George Foreman's white. Someone might hit you with his poison dart or something. Who else? I thought for me. I said, to Belgium. So we got off and they were screaming, Ali, Ali, Ali. And Ali goes, George Foreman's in Belgium. And they start screaming, Ali Boumaye. And I ask our interpreter, what does that mean? That means Ali kill him. Well, the Belgium used to put the German police dogs on the blacks over there. So when George gets off the airplane, he had a dog there, Diego, his German shepherd dog. He walked out, the people are saying, Belgium, Belgium. I said, Ali, we're home free.
There was only one fighter they were supporting from that point on. Let
me tell you something about the fight that night. Tickets were so expensive. There must have been maybe 15,000 poor people outside the stadium. This is a story never been discussed. So they're out by, you hear Ali Boma, yay, Ali Boma. You can hear them in the stadium. And this is like an hour before the fight. So I got in touch with Jim Pupu. He was the top aide to Mabuda. I said, Ali wants to see us. So I told Ali what to do. So we go back to the dressing room. Ali said, if you don't let those people in, I'm not fighting. You can't sell another ticket. He said, we can't let, that's not fair to the people who bought tickets. Oh, I'm not fighting. Swick came over. He went out, he let the people in. That was Ali.
Extraordinary. And obviously the duration of stay in Zaire was longer than expected because of Foreman's cut over his eye. So what was that like? Obviously, I'm sure Ali was quite disappointed at having to stay there for a bit longer and delaying the fight.
When we got there, I met with the American Embassy. So we got our food from the American Embassy. We had 20 people with us. So they got a supply of food. We paid for it all well and good. George Foreman stayed in a hotel, and we had. And then when the fight got postponed, working with MGM, I talked to Kirk Corcoran, who owned it. He sent us movies over. So we watched movies every night, the latest movies. So Ollie was happy there. He had his own cook, his own food, his own people he liked being around. He didn't have to travel anyone. No one's calling him and say, visit my aunt, she's sick, or come here, go there, you know, go to here. He was happy there. So it was a blessing in disguise, the Zaire fight.
B.B. King and James Brown were over there as well.
Yeah, they all went. They came there for the festival. Fizz. It was a fizz, too. But you say you watched the movie about When We Were Kings. They came over there to do a documentary on the jazz festival. And then the guy came around us, Guest, his name was, to shoot us. And then I said, come around. He shot. And that was more important than the fest. So he sold that for a lot of money.
Ali famously beat Foreman that night with tactics, I guess you'd describe as rope-a-dope, and possibly the only way he could have beaten Foreman that night, because Foreman was powerful, scary, terrifying.
No, but if you watch the fight now, Foreman comes out like this. Ali hit him, then Foreman was like this, and then Ali, he outsmarted him.
Those tactics, those rope-a-dope tactics that he...
His own. Listen, there was no man on planet Earth smarter in the ring than in the four posts. Frazier hit him one time, he pretended he was hurt. And Frazier didn't want to get involved with him. Frazier said himself, but he was hurt.
Would he talk about those tactics before the fight? Would he tell you guys what he was planning to do?
No, he said, I know what I'm doing. I mean, some people in the corner said, do this. He said, don't tell me a thing. I know what I'm doing.
Immediately after he knocks out Foreman in the eighth round, you're the first person in the ring. People watch the video back, you're close to it.
Well, yeah, there you go. My biggest fear was over there, should he get hurt? The hospitals are terrible. What do we do? I just couldn't believe it. You know, it's over, we're done now. And I begged him to retire after boxing. I begged him, Elijah Muhammad begged him, Minister Louis Farrakhan wanted him to fight. We don't want him to fight anymore. But he liked this. He liked the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd. He liked that. He should have. Could you imagine losing the title 10 years later, coming back, winning it? He'd have been more powerful now than ever.
For sure.
They tell me he fought too long. He's punched up. He had Parkinson's. His people had Parkinson's. Janet Reno, the Pope, different people had it. They never even participated in any sports.
I guess he fought, 22 times after he fought Foreman, even though people had kind of thought he was possibly coming towards the end of his career. He was 32 by that time. I know Freddie Pacheco, his doctor, had said he had been
Freddie
worried.
Freddie Pacheco had no say around this. End that story right there.
He had no say.
No.
Any of Ali's health concerns, and we all saw him at the Atlanta Olympic opening ceremony with the torch in 96. He was at the Special Olympics opening ceremony in Dublin in 2003 here in Ireland. And look, everyone knows he was failed in terms of his health in later years, still there probably in his head, but failed in body. Was any of that down to his sparring techniques? I know in sparring he enjoyed getting hit as much as possible.
He got Parkinson's disease. They don't know what causes it. There are people, as I said earlier, people have Parkinson's disease. They don't know what causes it. You know, with the boxing contribute, I don't know. I can't say. I'm not a doctor.
Did he have any regrets about continuing, about not retiring earlier? Did he ever speak about possibly?
No, we had a conversation one time. I'll tell you some of our private conversations. If you had your life to live over, Muhammad, would you do anything different? He said, no, then it wouldn't be me. What about you? I said, nope, it wouldn't be me either. It's my own thing. We did our own thing. Now, I had a conversation with him one time. This is very interesting. Who would win? Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay? Who do you think he picked? That's a good question for your listeners.
I would say he picked Ali.
You're right. He said Ali was more smarter now. Cassius Clay was moving around, jumping around. Ali would train better, do this. He told me one time, when you're fighting a George Foreman, you train different. When you're fighting a Cooperman, you train different. You know, when you're fighting a Chuck Wepner, you're trained different. When you're fighting a Joe Frazier, you're trained different. So he knew how to space himself.
Before the Foreman fight in 74, I'm going to take you back to 1972, so a couple of years earlier, and Aldo Lewis in Dublin, in Croke Park.
I was there.
You were there. Of course you were.
We used to eat at the Quinn restaurant. There was a restaurant at Quinn's. They were good to us and all.
What was that experience like? I know Muhammad was in Dublin for a week. I think he had a bit of a cold that week, but how was that entire experience for him, and how did he enjoy Ireland and the people?
He loved the people. We met Bernadette Devlin. She came by to say hello. With a lot of people. Everybody loved them. You know, and they said, oh, we're so proud you're Irish. Say, I'm Irish. But everybody loved him. He loved them. And
The fight
could have been a tough fight for him, but he was in shape and came home victorious.
It was the 11th round TKO against Aldo Lewis that time. I think it was maybe 25,000 people had been in Croke
they
Park had, for the fight.
They scaled the walls, I remember.
Yeah, the walls of Hill 16.
Yeah.
So those people hadn't paid for tickets. There was just maybe 5,000 people who, once the opening bell had rung,
I was proud of them coming over the walls. They're the Irish. That's my heritage. Can't put us down.
Absolutely. That was a proud moment, I'm sure, for Ali to fight in Ireland. Was travel something on his horizon? Was it his intention to fight in as many places?
He didn't mind traveling. He liked it. We flew first class. The big thing when we traveled anywhere, everyone from coach would come up and be asking him for autographs and talking to him and all. Then the pilots would get mad and the stewards, you got to stay back and coach.
You can tell me if this story is true or not, but I think it's probably from the late 80s. I had read that Muhammad had done a tour, I think, to Lebanon, and he had heard the bombs and the bullets, and he had written you a letter on Middle East Airlines stationery.
Yeah, I have that letter.
You have that letter?
I'll send you a copy of it.
Ah, perfect. What can you remember about what he said in that letter?
That'd be amazing. I'll send you a copy of that letter.
Fantastic. That'd be great. I'll frame it beside this
poster.
Yeah,
you did your homework.
Absolutely. But what did that... I've read the
letter. I have a picture of me carrying his mom when I was a pallbearer, too. I'll send you that.
Excellent. He called you at the end of that little short note.
Your boy.
Your boy. He said, Muhammad, your boy. And he had kind of spoken of his warmth and the good times with you and the moments he'd had with you. So did little things like that mean a lot to you years later?
Yeah, you know, some guy called me on the phone. He said, I want to buy that for $100,000. I don't want to sell it. My championship ring, there's only five have this one. This is the real one.
That's the inner circle ring.
I'll send you pictures.
Fantastic. So, explain to people what that ring means. That's the only people in Muhammad's inner circle had that ring, essentially.
His dad, his brother, myself, Minister Louis Farrakhan, Abdul Rahman.
You're the last living person to have that ring.
The last one there.
That's incredible.
But I was accepted by all them people. You know, when I met with Elijah Muhammad, he said, the white people is a devil. I don't look at you as a devil. I look at the white man who raped the black man's wife, raped the black man's daughter, deprived the black man getting an education, beat him, put him in slavery. You must be a devil. He said, there's a greater power than us. Then Muhammad Ali and I, Allah has you here. That's a lot of responsibility for me, isn't it? That God sent you here. But he loved the man. He loved Muhammad Ali and Muhammad loved you. And if he didn't accept that religion, who knows what he would have been. He might have been cleaning bus stations in Louisville. It gave him a whole new identity.
Understandably, Muhammad's fame led him to meet a lot of other celebrities, and yourself included. And I've seen the photo of yourself and Elvis Presley. I watched a video last night of yourself and a good friend of yours, Tony Curtis, Hollywood legend. I'm sure you met presidents, emperors, all sorts of people. So can you tell us a few of those stories of introducing Ali to people like Elvis?
We went, my friend, I played football in the service with Tom Hewlett, Concerts West. He took Elvis on tour. And Elvis was here in Vegas. Muhammad wanted to see him. I called him. We went back there. And we go in there, and we had the best seats in the house. And Elvis came out. He sang a song. Then he said, in the audience is the greatest of all time. Stand up, Muhammad. Muhammad got up. He was so excited. He called him Everless. Everless, he pointed. You're the best. You're the best. So we go backstage, and all he told him, he said, you got to hang with me. He said, no, I can't go anywhere. All the boys around, he can't go anywhere. He said, if you didn't have the glasses and the cape and all, walk down the street with me, they wouldn't know who you were. He said, you became a prisoner in your own body. You got to get out and mix with the people. He said, I go anywhere, everywhere. Nobody bothers me. And they said, no, he can't do that. And then one of the flunkies said, oh, he's so tough. He knows karate and this, he knows that. So Ali said, Elvis, you're too pretty. You do the singing, I do the fighting. And then he gave him the robe. He made that robe up for him. That great robe that he gave him.
Was he a pleasant guy, Elvis? Was he, what was he, good, what was he like to talk to?
He was just like, those guys, you look at them and you think they're not Rhodes Scholars. They're not great scientists. They're just innocent guys that became big, powerful people. You know, Ali had the innocence of boyhood, but he had the dignity of man. You know, when you talk to him one-on-one, it's like a little, you know, the innocence he had.
You're sitting in Las Vegas, Nevada right now, and I know that's somewhere where that's close to your heart. I think you moved there in 1980, if I'm correct.
78, go ahead.
78, 2 years out. I mean, you worked as a fixer, a greeter, you know, a friend to the city's high rollers.
Not a greeter, I was an executive. In the casino business, one of the top executives.
What was life like in the casinos in Vegas over the last, I think it's approaching, what is it, four decades possibly since you've lived there?
I remember everybody got dressed up to go to the shows like they were going to date Elvis. All the men wore suits. You don't see that now. I mean, it's unbelievable. Everybody was like unreal. Unreal. Everybody wanted to come to Vegas. If you were came to New York and you were Frankenstein and you seen a pretty girl, you could give her your card. Come to Vegas. She'd be out on the next airplane. Everybody wanted to come to Vegas. That's what it was about, the entertainers. All the top entertainers. They do the Ed Sullivan Show, then they're out here. All of them. This was a city. I always told Ali, I said, this will be a great city. I'd like to live here. Wouldn't it be nice? But then I bought a house here in 78, and then I didn't move back into it. Ali went back to fight. I went back with him, and then I moved out in 80. But it was a great city. There's no locks on the door. Now everything's locked up. Always something going on.
So the city's changed, but what happens in Vegas? Does it still stay there?
No, there's no secrets here. I don't know who came up with that. I mean, and then people exaggerate, you know. Everybody exaggerates. People came up to me, they said, Ali bought my mom a house down in North Las Vegas. I said, really? That's good. Never happened, you know.
Was that a tough thing for Muhammad, that he had a lot of hanger-oners, I guess you call them, for want of a better phrase, that people knew him
Jesus
or thought they knew him?
Jesus had apostles and disciples. Muhammad had his inner circle and outer circle. The inner circle was everything. I mean, like I said, Ali would meet a guy, now he wants to be his best friend. Larry Holmes took us to a prison in eastern Pennsylvania. There were 13 black guys and me. We had the big mobile home. We went into the prison, visiting everybody. We get out in the bus. There were 14 black guys and me. I said, who are you? He said, I just got out with you. Ali said, good, you can say what I said at the training camp. I said, no, we're going to drop them off at the airport. We went to the Allentown Airport, gave him $2,000 and a ticket. But that was Ali. You know,
extraordinary man. Later in life then, what was Ali's attitude like? I know we've spoken about his health, but he passed away in 2016. I think he was 74 years of age. Of course, there was a massive ceremony after his passing in Louisville. Yeah. And I know you were involved heavily with that. And it was almost something that resembled the death of a president or a king or an emperor.
Well, I wasn't heavily involved. His wife took care of all that. But I made sure that Jim Brown, Larry Holmes, Chris Christopherson, Eddie Walson, who owns cable television, and myself were there. We had our own vehicle, our own entrance, everything, you know. But it was an unbelievable thing, you know, it was unbelievable.
Do you remember the last time you spoke with him?
Yeah, I went to his birthday, his 60th. I would call him on the phone and he couldn't talk that well. But I got pictures, I'll send you some, of his 69th birthday where we went and spoke and all. And he was pretty sharp then. And he would say, do we have a good time? Yeah. And then I said, George Foreman just called. He wants a rematch. Good, I'll give him a rematch. And then I told George, I said, I don't want no rematch.
Where would Muhammad, this is a hypothetical, of course, but where would he sit in terms of boxing today? I mean, I've read a quote from you where it was something along the lines of he would make 250 million pay-per-views easy, 100 million for people to watch him eating breakfast with his wife.
I said that.
Yeah, that I was said, yourself. So
no, what, I said,
where would he
I
sit?
I told Floyd Mayweather, I said, if Muhammad Ali and I had breakfast together, we'd outdry you on closed circuit TV. See, that's the big thing today, closed circuit. That's where all the money is made. The gate is for the expenses and for the fighters. But all the other stuff, that closed circuit TV, is on foreign rights. They used to give it away one time. Now they sell it.
What's his ultimate legacy then, Muhammad? I mean, we've spoken about his religion. We've spoken about standing up when it came to not wanting to fight in Vietnam for a cause he didn't believe in. We've spoken about his massive career in boxing and those achievements.
Okay.
What's his legacy?
That's a great question. There's an old Chinese proverb that said, you're never dead as long as you're remembered. So Muhammad will be remembered like they remembered Mahatma Gandhi, the Kennedys, you know, Abraham Lincoln. He'll be remembered. People remember, we traveled all over the world, unbelievable. Met Gaddafi, the Shah of Iran, President Marcos, met the presidents, you know, unbelievable. He will be remembered. I think he made big shots humble.
Extraordinary. And I can sense from reading interviews with yourself even that you have adopted some of his I guess, outlook on life. And if you don't mind me saying, I mean, I read you speaking about your own health issues of late, and I know your twin brother Billy had passed earlier this year, and your attitude towards that in an interview that I saw was, you know, that he's in a better place, and you'd spoken very warmly about him and about your relationship and about his passing. So do you think you've adopted some of Ali's, I guess, outlook on life?
Well, we contribute to each other. You know, when I was interviewed at his funeral, there was a press guy came up, Ken Jones from London. And he said, how do you feel about Muhammad? I said, I'm sure he's in heaven. When he met St. Peter at the gate, St. Peter said, Muhammad, nice to see you. How about signing some autographs, gloves, and go right in? I said, when he went in there, he's back with his mom and dad and Joe Lewis and all the good people. Like he said in Zaire, Africa, nobody can get to me here now. Nobody can get to him in heaven. He's happy, he's there. And that's something that I look for. Someday going back and hanging with him and his mom and dad and my mom and dad. The old days, that's something we look for. That's about religion. Look at the Irish, they had the potato famine. Look at their faith. I mean, unbelievable, their faith. So when I see Ali believing in Allah, look what they went through, and they still believed in a God and a Jesus, and all them people killed, died in boats coming over here.
There's a big market for sports memorabilia, and as you said, a lot of your stuff is sentimental value, doesn't matter about the monetary value. I myself collect autographs. I certainly did when I was younger, or tried to collect autographs. But I'm sure you have a lot of things in your collection. You mentioned the note that Muhammad signed for you in the Middle Eastern Airlines stationery. Do you have much other things that you kept from your time with him?
I got pictures and all that he signed, you know. I got gloves, and you know, sometimes there's a charity coming up, the Shriners Hospital, they'll need something, I'll give it to him. I'm not going to give it to some guy and then he sells it on eBay. A guy came up to me before one of the fights, I signed one of the sparring gloves. It wasn't Ali, anybody. Next thing I know, I don't sign that much, and I seen it was for sale on eBay. And he sold it for $8,000. So
incredible. The quote that you mentioned earlier, I think it was from Odessa, Muhammad's mother, we're born to leave the world in a better place than we found it. I'm sure you believe that of Muhammad, that in the immediate aftermath of his passing in 2016 and the immediate reaction to his death and the legacy he left, that certainly that was something that was very true of him.
Well, you know, as we're talking, you're Irish, I'm Irish, and you have a big sports hero over there, McGregor. You know, if he's a good kid, a nice kid, if he had a Gene Kilroy around him, he wouldn't be that crazy. You know, he should look at Muhammad and try to, like, I bet he never visited a hospital, but he does a lot of charitable things, I've heard, and gets in fights in bars and shit. When you do something wrong, they never forget it, you know. So that you know, he's a good kid. I met him once or twice. I looked goodbye, but I didn't get into a conversation with him. But he what Muhammad did for boxing, he did for MMA.
You've been very good with your time, Gene. It's been extraordinary to hear a lot of your stories. You mentioned Red Hurley there. I mean, for people that don't know, and everyone in Ireland here and listening to this.
Let's do a thing about Red. Yeah, you could edit it.
Yeah,
I have a friend of mine in Ireland who is one of the greatest voices ever. He's on tune. I wish at that time when I met him, I wasn't so tied up with Ali. If I would have got involved with Red Hurley, in America, he would have been just as big as Sinatra, Elvis, the Beatles, Tom Jones. He has the perfect voice. And I'm family. Red Hurley is family to me. His wife, his kids, his brother. I went over to spend a week with Red Hurley. I wouldn't go anywhere to see anybody for a week. I went there we went to a show. He sang. I play his music all the time. You know, when my brother died, we played his music. Keeper of the Stars, he recorded that. Everybody in the church start crying. You know, he's family. He stayed at my house here. His daughter visited me here. They stayed at the hotel. You know, I was just invited to his daughter's wedding. I couldn't make it. I wasn't traveling that much then. But he's a good guy, and I just wish him luck. And I'm going to return over there to see him. But two things you tell Red. We send our best, and McGregor, take a page out of Ali's book. And if he needs any help, I'm there for him. We love him. He came the hard way. Ali came the hard way. We all came the hard way.
Will you make it back over to Ireland, or are you planning to get back over here?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to come over. About another year when I'm feeling a little better. I'm looking forward to it.
And how are you feeling now? Obviously, this
feeling
is a tough
good.
Time for
I get up every day. I have my guys I hang with, Pat Cooper, Checky Green, Pete Barbuti, our little group hangs together. It's like the celebrity breakfast. Everybody wants to have breakfast with us, but it's invitation only.
Well, listen, when you come over to Ireland, I might invite you to breakfast, and we can go for a pint of Guinness.
Good luck to you, and I'm proud of you. You did a great job. You did a great homework, and take
Perfect.
Care.
Pleasure. Gene Kilroy, thanks very much, and pleasure to talk to you this afternoon.
Okay.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.